Ravana originally, when he came to Chicago, was Rosh Yeshiva of what's called the Skokie Yeshiva, Hebrew Theological College. Right. And he spent his Chatur, he's on Carpenter Road. And then he started his own yeshiva, Yeshivat Brisk. Brisk was the town in Europe from which his family came. Reb Chaim was the Rav of Brisk. And so he started Yeshivat Brisk. Yeshivat Brisk today really doesn't function as a full yeshiva. It's more of a community, a place where people from the community learn. They also have a Vatikan minion there, Sunrise minion, and so forth. In any event, talking about this week's parsha for a minute, and connected to Shavuos, and also, you know, there's as you all know, we read the Torah portions according to a certain cycle, right? In other words, we very famous on Simchas Torah, right? On Shmini Atzeret here in Israel, in Chutz Laaretz, on the ninth day, so to speak, on Simchas Torah, we make a seal, we finish the Torah of the Zot HaBracha, and we begin Bereishit, and then the next Parsha, next Shabbat, is Parshas Bereishit. So in the Jewish year, we finish the Torah. In fact, sometimes we even double up Parshiot, right? We have over the last few weeks, like Achrei Mot Kedoshim, we read together in order to make the cycle come out so that we'll finish the Torah reading within a year. Okay. First of all, you should know that was not the universal practice at the time of Chazal. In other words, there were really two practices. Basically, the practice in Eretz Yisrael was to complete the Torah in a three-year cycle. And then the practice in Babel was a one-year cycle, and then that became the universal practice, was a one-year cycle. However, in addition to that, there were certain readings that were to take place during the year. For example, on Yontif, you read special parshiot that are related to Yontif, right? You have the four special parshiot before Pesach, like Parshat Shtalim or Parshat Zohor, right? In some communities, that was the parsha that was read, that Shabbat. There was no other parsha read. In other communities, it was done like we do it today, where it was done as an additional parsha, it's a mafter parsha or whatever. There was a very old takana from the time of Ezra. Ezra HaKohen, you know, who was the one who brought the Jewish people, was the leader of the community that came back and established the second Beit HaMikdash after 70 years of exile after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, who's responsible, really, for much of Torah Shabbat Peh that we have today, in the structure and so forth, and is Ezra HaKohen. So he made a takana. He made a takana that we should read what's called the Gemara in Megillah, Brachot V'Klalo, before the Brachot V'Klalo of Torah Kohanim, that's Sefer Vayikra, should be read before Shavuot, and Brachot V'Klalo of Sefer Devarim in Parshas Kitavo should be read before Rosh Hashanah. That's what the Takana was. And the Rambam brings that halacha. In fact, we do that today. That's our practice today, as I'll explain. But the Rambam brings it in a little bit of a larger context. The Rambam says that the basis for this idea is that before Yontif, right, the Yontif of Shavuos in the case of the Brachot V'Klalot that we read before Shavuot, and in the case of Rosh Hashanah before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, Sukkot, that we should read something that will sort of prepare us for the Yontif, so to speak. Okay? Just like on Yontif itself, we read about the Yontif, right? On Pesach, we read Parshot having to do with Pesach. On Sukkot, we read Parshot having to do with Sukkot. Really, the Mishnah on Rosh Hashanah, we also should read the Parshot and the Torah that deal with Rosh Hashanah. Instead, the practice today is to read about the Akedat Yitzchak and the birth of Yitzchak and so forth, but that also is related to Rosh Hashanah, okay, in some way. So here, what the Rambam felt was that what the Takana Ezra was that before Yontif, too, in preparation for the Yontif, we should read something that's connected to the other. And he gives two other examples. He says that that in most years, what he calls a Shana Pshuta, meaning where there's not a Shana Mubera, where you don't have a 13th month in the year, an ordinary year like we have this year, ordinarily Parsha Sav is read before Pesach. And he says also ordinarily, Parshat Vatchanan is read after Tisha B'Av. Now, there are two interesting things about that. One is, we'll get back to Brachot and Klalot in a moment, but what does Parshas Sav have to do with Pesach? Parshas Vatchanan, we understand what it has to do with Tisha B'Av. We can read it on Tisha B'Av. But it's interesting, there he says it's read after Tisha B'Av. If you ask the average person, they'll tell you, no, Devarim has to be read before Tisha B'Av. But that's not how the Rambam words it. The Rambam words it that Vatchanan is read after Tisha B'Av. Also, if you ask the average person, they'll tell you, we read Bamidbar before Shavuot. But that's not really it. We really read B'Chukotai on this Shabbat. That's what's significant, according to the Takanat Ezra. Or the average person will tell you we read Ten Nitzavim before Rosh Hashanah, right? No, that's not what the Takanah was. The Takanah was to read Kitavo before Rosh Hashanah. It just so happens that we separate by 2 weeks, so we end up reading Ten Nitzavim before Rosh Hashanah. And it just so happens, I mean it's a bit correct. We don't believe anything just so happens. But it is true that Atem Nitzavim is related to Rosh Hashanah because the Parsha of Tshuva is there. But really, the reason that we end up reading Atem Nitzavim right immediately before Rosh Hashanah is because we have to read Brachot Klalot 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah is out. So anyway, just briefly, why do we read Tzav before Pesach? So Rav Aaron suggested that the reason we read Tzav before Pesach is because the Tzav is the Parsha of Hagdolat Kelim. In other words, we read the mitzvah of in the Beit HaMikdash, all right, but of being Magil Kelim, that means kashering Kelim, okay, through, you know, immersing it in boiling water or through fire, whatever the method is, okay? So that's something that's preparatory to Pesach, right? That's a very important part of preparing for Pesach is Hagalat Kelim. You see on the streetcars, right, in a lot of neighborhoods, they'll have Hagalat Kelim. With regard to Tisha B'Av, very interesting. As I said, it's clear that the Parsha Ki Tol Libanim, which we read on Tisha B'Av, is in Vatchanan. But why is it dafka after Tisha B'Av? So there, Rav Aaron explained, because there's a concept by onshin, by punishment, that the Gemara against Gemara Megillah says, Poronito lo makdamina. We don't push up something that's a negative experience, something that's a punitive kind of experience. An example is this year with regard to Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av this year falls on Shabbat. When do we make it? You can't make the Tzom on Shabbat itself, so when do we make it? We make it on Sunday. Why don't we move it up to Thursday like we do with Ta'anit Hester or with the Ta'anit B'Charot? The answer is because Kornita lo mekdakinima. We don't push up something, a negative experience. We put it off till a later day, so to speak. So the same thing, the Atchanan comes after Tisha B'Av, not before Tisha B'Av. Now again, it works out, you know, because Chazal, designed it that way, that Devarim also is related to Tisha B'Av, because in Devarim we read about the Meraglim, again, the Parsha Meraglim, which is the first Tisha B'Av, had to do with the spies, the Jewish spies who didn't give a good report about the land of Israel. So it works out, but really the reason that we read Devarim before Tisha B'Av is because we read Vatchanan after Tisha B'Av. And the reason we read it after is for Poronita Lomakdanina, we don't push up a negative experience. We don't try to hurry punitive kind of experiences, avelu mourning kind of experiences. We don't try to push those up, so to speak. Okay. But getting back to Brachot and Klalot before Shavuot, before Rosh Hashanah. Brachot and Klalot are better known as the Tochacha. We read the Tochacha in this week's Parsha, Parsha B'Chukotai. We'll read it another Tochacha in Parsha Kitavo before Rosh Hashanah. What is Brachot and Klalot? That is, it's basically the reward and punishment that faces the Jewish people, not as individuals, but as a community. In other words, if we'll do the right thing, if we'll follow Torah and mitzvos, right, good things are going to happen to the Jewish people as a community. And if we don't, we believe in reward and punishment. It's basic tenet of the Jewish faith, one of the Yud Gimel Karim of the Rambam. Bad things are going to happen. And in fact, unfortunately, that's been the history of the Jewish people, you know, that we've suffered whatever is recorded in the Torah plus, you know, more than that. And we don't have to look back too far in history to find how catastrophically the Jewish people have suffered as individuals and as a community. But, so what does this have to do with Shavuot? So Rav Aaron suggested part of the Brachot and Klalot is that this was part of the Brit, part of the covenant that we made with God. In other words, we voluntarily entered into this breach. I mean, there is a concept, you know, parakahigit, that we were held under, you know, some pressure. But even if that's true, then we're told at the time of Purim, ki muvah kiblu, that we accepted voluntarily. So we took the expression that's used in the Torah is that we took an alah, an oath, right? We took a shvu'ah, that's another word for an oath. We took a the expressions used were mushba'a va'omed mehar sinai. It's a very common expression in Chazal. We're sworn to keep the Torah. In other words, we made a binding oath upon ourselves and upon our children and grandchildren or all the generations that we would keep the Torah. Okay? And so part of the deal is, if you keep the Torah, good things happen. If you don't keep the Torah, bad things happen. So we're mushba va'omed mehar sinai, right? So part of the breed that was preparatory to the giving of the Torah was this idea of the Jewish people are taking an oath, and they're going to be bound to this oath, not only on their word, so to speak, but also consequences will flow if they violate this oath. It's interesting, Shavuos is called Shavuos because in the Torah it's called Chagat Shavuot because of the weeks that we count, the Sirus Omer between Pesach and Shavuos. Shavuos in Lashon Chazal, by the way, is called Atzeret, which means like a concluding holiday, because it's the conclusion of Pesach, really. That's what Shavuot is, because the whole purpose of Pesach, as Moshe Rabbeinu was told at the time of the burning bush, was Tavdun et Elokim al Arzel, that you would serve God on this mountain, on Har Sinai. So, since Matan Torah is very connected to Pesach, but there's a practice among certain Hasidim to learn Masechet Shavuot between Pesach and Shavuot. Why? It has 49 dafim, there are 49 days, as you know. And so a daf a day, that's the original daf yomi, you know, before the Maharam in Lublin came up with the idea of daf yomi. That was a daf yomi, right? You did every day for 49 days. Now, I just got done saying Shavuot means weeks. But Shavuos also has another context. It has a context of, oh, that's what Shavuos is about. It's one of the Mesechto that deals with oaths, like Nedarim or Nazir, right? So, again, it's the idea that we're mushba va'omei mehar sinai. We took an oath. And that's part of what we're experiencing now, is reliving that period of time in which we committed ourselves, you know, to the Torah and to mitzvos in terms of an oath. Now, that explains Shavuos. Okay, what about Rosh Hashanah? What is Brachot Kvalot? What does all this have to do with Rosh Hashanah? So Ravine suggested that really there were two experiences we had of Matan Torah. One experience we're going to celebrate on Shavuot. That was when the Luchot HaRishonot were brought. That's when the first set of tablets were brought. We know that didn't end so well, right? In other words, Moshe came down from the mountain 40 days later, we're told on that comes out in Shivas and the Tammuz, and you know the Luchot were broken because the Jewish people had turned to worship the golden calf, right? Maybe it wasn't Avodah Zarah originally, but by the end it certainly was. And so because of this terrible avera, you know, the Luchot were broken, and then there was a period of tshuva, Moshe pleading with God, the chiddush of tshuva and so forth. And then Moshe brought down the second set of Luchot when? On Yom Kippur. Okay? So Ryan suggested that really the Brachot Klalot that we read before Rosh Hashanah is not just Rosh Hashanah, it's really before Yom Kippur. Because Yom Kippur is also a day of Matan Torah. By the way, the Gemara says this. The Gemara says that there were 2 days that were among the most joyous days of the Hebrew calendar. One was Tu B'Av, right? And the Gemara gives various reasons for that. And then it says, and the other was Yom Kippur. Like on those 2 days, Shidduchim were made. You know, on Tu B'Av and on Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur, the Gemara gives 2 reasons. One you would expect, because it's Kapara, right? We get Kapara for Aveirot. But the other reason the Gemara gives is because it was the time of Matan Torah, because the second set of Luchos were given on Yom Kippur. And then, so now we can say, in other words, that the Brachot Klalot, like we said, are part of the Brit, part of the Shavua, part of the Oath, part of the commitment that we as the Jewish people make before Matan Torah. And we had to do it twice. We had to do it before the first set of loopholes were given and before the second set of loopholes were given. Prabhupada went further. He said that it's very famous, his great-grandfather was Zabeta Levi, the first of Yoshibera Soloveitchi. And he has a very famous piece in his Sefer where he discusses, based on Midrashim and so forth, the difference between the first set of loopholes and the set of second loopholes. According to Chazal, the first set of luchos somehow miraculously contained not only all of Torah Shebichtav, but also all of Torah Shebaal Peh. In other words, that all of the Mishnayot, all the Halachot, at least they're included in the Mishnayot and the Gemara and so forth, were included somehow miraculously, were written into, after all, it's God's hand, were written into the first set of luchos. But things didn't work out so well, right? That set of luchos were broken. So at that point, God Kaviyachol made the decision that he would separate Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. So that now Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, the Mishnayot, the Gemara, and so forth, became Baal Peh, right? I mean, now they're written down because of the various Sarot and so forth, so eight laws, so Hashem, we wrote them down. But really, that was not to be written down, that was to be oral law. And so Ryan suggested that Shavuot, we celebrate the giving of Torah Shebichtav. And on Yom Kippur, we celebrate the giving of Torah Shebaal Peh. And that the first brachot and kolot are related to the brief that we have with respect to Torah Shebichtav. And the second set of brachot and kolot are related to the brief that we have with respect to Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, Rav Aaron will even further than that, and I'll at least share one more thing he said. He said that one of the basic changes that took place between the first set of luchos and the second set of luchos was the role of Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu was the shliach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He was God's messenger, so to speak. But now, once the first set of luchos were broken, and he went up to the har again to receive the second set of luchos, his role changed. Now he was no longer just a shliach, no longer just a rebbe, but he was going to be the conduit through which Torah Shebaal Peh would be given to the Jewish people. He was Torah itself. He was Torah Shebaal Peh. That's why the Rambam emphasized, I mentioned the 13 Ikarim before, that one of the basic Ikarim is that Moshe was the greatest Navi of all times. There wasn't anyone like him before him or after him. It means Avraham Avinu, Yitzhak Yaakov, not like Moshe Rabbeinu. Anyone who would come after him. It doesn't matter whether it was Rabbi Akiva or the Vilna Gaon or Chaim Soloveitchik. No one was like Moshe Rabbeinu. I remember one time, I'll tell you a story about Rav Aaron, that once we were at a Levaya of a group, one of the Gdolei Hador, it's not appropriate to say who, and one of the Maspidim, one of the persons who gave a eulogy, said that so-and-so, Rabbi Yaakov, so-and-so, he was Torah. And Rav Aaron very much objected to that, because Rav Aaron always felt that you couldn't say that about anyone except Moshe Rabbeinu. Only about Moshe Rabbeinu could you say Torah Moshe, the same thing. Anyone else, he has his view. You can argue with him. I mean, that's part of our Torah process. Everyone can have dayot, everyone can argue, no one has a corner on Torah, so to speak. Okay? The one person who did was Moshe Rabbeinu. He was the conduit for which Torah Shebaal Peh was given to the Jewish people. And Torah Shebaal Peh ended with Moshe. There was no Torah, it developed in the sense of it was to be a living Torah, but there were no new, there couldn't be any chidushim, no other Nevi'im could come up with any chidushim, right? That's a rule that it ain't, I don't know what that is. No, it's his fireworks. I was here the night of the Pigua and we heard that, we thought it was fireworks at first. I don't know if you know about this, about 4 years ago, Purim, there was a Pigui. Well, you're right here, right underneath us. My class was going on, it was a Thursday night. And we thought it was fireworks at first. And then when we realized, we heard someone screaming, and so we had pictured, there was an incident in the United States that where this shooter went around a university and was shooting people. So we decided we'd block the doors. And that's what we did. We kind of laid on the floor until the police came and then released us. So anyway. Yeah.
I have a question on that, though.
Yeah.
You said about, there's a story, obviously, with Hashem showed Moshe Rabbi Akiva.
Right.
Right? And, you know, he didn't understand
what, was going on this year, right?
He said that I love the Moshe Rabbi Sinai, I felt better.
Right.
The point is that the Moshe Rabbi had, this is what I do.
I just want to make sure this is
fireworks.
Well, why are there fireworks tonight? What's going on? Unless it's for Yom Yerushalayim, so you
think. Yeah.
Anyway, no, you're right. In other words, that.
So, what you guys in that story is that the right. Moshe is constantly.
Yeah, it is evolving. It is evolving. But when we say Ein Rishoy Lenavi Lachadesh Dover, it means he can't come up with something totally new. In other words, Rabbi Akiva built on Halacha Moshe Sinai. He built on the Torah that was given to Moshe. Right? That's what Rabbi Akiva built on. So. There's a lot of meaning to that story. It's a very important story. I can't go into all of it, but you're right to ask the question. I know what you're saying. It doesn't mean, I mean, we talk about Chidushim, right? I said Rav Aaron was, I don't know if I meant that, Big Baal HaKadosh and so forth. So we talk about, but it's Chidushim within an existing body of principles and laws and concepts and so forth, right? No one's adding a 614th mitzvah, so to speak. Okay? So, Rav Aaron, I'll just mention this and then I'll conclude. Rav Aaron said that, went on to say that, you know, Chazal say that there's a difference between the Baruch Hu and Kolot, there are several differences between the Baruch Hu and Kolot that we read in Sefer Vayikra, in Torah Sekhmanim, and that which we read in Sefer Devarim. And they talk about the ones in Sefer Devarim, Sefer Vayikra were Miki HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the ones in Sefer Devarim were Miki Moshe. So the question is, what do you mean they were Miki Moshe? What does that mean? After all, isn't it a principle of our faith that the Torah was given to Moshe by HaKadosh Baruch Hu? HaKadosh Baruch Hu dictated every word. Moshe didn't make up the Torah himself. That's what the Apikoros can say. So again, according to Rav Aaron's shot, we can understand it, right? Because what does it mean that it was given by Miki Moshe? Because the second set of Luchos, which the predecessor was the Brachot and Klalot, of Sefer Devarim, of Parshat Kitavo, those are the part of the brief that was made with regard to Torah Sheba'al Peh. And Moshe does represent Torah Sheba'al Peh. So in other words, Moshe's role had changed, right? When the first set of luchos were given, Moshe was not a mashbiyah, he was a mushba, right? He was together with all the other people, right? But when the second set of luchos, suddenly his role changed. Now he was standing like with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak. He was a mashbiya now. By the way, it's also between the first set of luchos and the second set of luchos that Moshe gets the carne or, you know, the horns of light emitted from his head again, because his role changed. You know, his role as far as Torah, he was no longer, I want to say just a Malavi, because that's very important. He was a Malavi, a Rebbe, to Klal Yisrael. But he was also now the conduit through which Torah Sheba'al Peh would be conveyed to Klal Yisrael, a very important role. So I said that I would mention something Rav Aaron said connected to the parasha, which is also connected to Shavuot. As I mentioned earlier, Shavuot is really, I understand some of you anyway, are candidates for Giyur. Shavuot is really the, you could say, the Chag of Geirut, of Giyur, in the sense that a few senses. One is that how do we know the halachot of Giyur? How do we know what a person has to do in order to be mitgayer? We know it from Matan Torah, right? In connection with Matan Torah, they had to have brit milah. They had to have tefillah. They had to bring, they had carbon. We don't have carbon today. And then most important, they had, what did you say?
They had bris before.
Right. Well, it started really with before the carbon pesach. But that question's even asked as to whether that's discussed, as to whether that Brit Milah could count for their Geirut, so to speak. In other words, the Jews, until only Shevet Levi really kept the Brit Milah, even they kept it as part of the Beit Avraham, right? Because they came from the other Shvatim did not have Brit Milah, right? Many Midrashim and Midrashim Chazal and so forth that talk about this. So they had the Brit Milah really 49 days earlier, you know, before the Karmel Pesach. But it was also connected as part of that process of Geirut. That's a whole other story in itself, too. But in any event, and then most important, they had Kabbalat Mitzvot, right? When I'd say the Haredi community, but anyone who is the Orthodox community, the Haredi community may object to some of the viewer practices of our community, the Dati-Lumi community, so to speak. But we, as the Orthodox community, our objection to the Gior that's done by the conservative and reform and others who are non-Orthodox is not so much the Mila and Tevila. You know, those things are fairly simple. It's the Kabbalat mitzvot. There's not a real commitment to mitzvot, right? There's not a commitment to mitzvot in the sense of someone who's really going to keep Shabbat and Kashrut and Tarat and Mishpacha and so forth. It's very, very basic to Gior. Rav Aaron felt very strongly about that. Even though there are Rambams on it and so forth, which maybe are a little bit ambiguous, but it's clear that the practice of Jews always was that the most important aspect of Gior was Kabbalat mitzvot. Has to include Kabbalat mitzvot. All right, now, the finally I'll say that the other connection between Shavuot and Gior is Rut. Rut represents, right, we read Megillat Rut on Shavuot, and Rut represents like the paradigm, the highest form of Gior that we can think of. And why is that? Because look where she came from. She was a Moabitess princess. She had it pretty good, right? In fact, Naomi says to her, you know, go back. What do you need this? What do you need my hardships for? Go back to your people and so forth. And in fact, Orpah chose it, right? But Ruth did it. She clung to Naomi anyway and clung to the Torah and the mitzvos and so forth. And that is a very important concept that Rav Aaron stressed also, which I think is something, a message that those of you who are candidates for Gior can take upon yourselves and also the rest of us. And that is that Judaism, Torah is not a tranquilizer. What do I mean by that? It's, while it's true that we believe that ultimately Torah and mitzvot will give a person a good life, peace of mind, happiness, good family life, right? Wholesome kind of living, enjoyable kind of living, doing the right things in life and so forth. We believe all those things. But that doesn't mean that there's a guarantee that Torah comes without hardship, comes without suffering. There are many people who are very Torah observant, very close to Torah, and yet they live very hard lives. And our commitment to Torah can't be based on what's it going to give me. You know, even though I talked earlier about reward and punishment and so forth, that's not the basis for which any of us, whether you're a candidate to become a ger or whether you're already a committed Jew, that should not be the basis of your commitment. Your basis for your commitment is not what I'm going to get out of Torah. Oh, you know why? Torah is good because it's good to take off a day on Shabbos, you know, it feels good and so forth. I have a good family life, this kind of thing. Gives me peace of mind, gives me direction. All these things may well be true, but that's not the reason we keep Torah. The reason we keep Torah is because we're mushba ba'omei ne'ar Sinai. We made a commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're the chosen people, so to speak. Chosen for what? Chosen to keep Torah and mitzvot. And even though sometimes for everyone has ups and downs in life, and life can be very hard at times, there's no person who doesn't suffer in his life in some way. And not that, God forbid, I don't wish on any of you or on myself or anyone suffering. Everyone has hardships. Everyone has troubles. Everyone has suffering. And our role as a committed Jew, as committed Jews, and the role of a ger is that I accept the Torah af al pi kein. It doesn't make any difference. In other words, I'm not taking on Judaism because I think it's a beautiful way of life or something like that. I'm taking on Judaism. I'm taking on Torah mitzvahs because it's the right thing to do. Why is it the right thing to do? Because it's the will of God and I committed to it. I'm part of the chosen people who chose to commit themselves to fulfill the will of God regardless of the circumstances. And Ruth represents that kind of person. Despite the hardships, despite the unknown she faced, and even though her life also ended in a happy way in the sense that she had marriage, although Chazal tells it was a very brief marriage, but she was able to be the progenitor of David HaMelech, which is also interesting that he comes from Gerim, as did Rabbi Akiva, Ulklas HaGer, so many famous Gerim and so forth. But they all chose to Torah and mitzvot, these famous Gerim, you know, throughout Jewish history, chose Torah and mitzvot in the same way that the Jewish people did initially, going through the same ceremony, so to speak, but the same commitment, the same Kabbalat mitzvot, without Tanaim without conditions, right? An unconditional love relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I wish all of you a good Shabbat, Shabbat Shalom, and should have a good Shavuos, a good Kabbalah Satorah, as they say, a Kabbalah Satorah. I pray that you all have lives that are filled with happiness and good health and smachot and Torah learning and living in a very happy, uplifting way. And but the most important, you and myself, we all stay committed to Torah and Mitzvos as our forefathers have for the last 3,300 years since the original Kabbalah has come. Okay. Any questions or anything?
Any questions? I hate to ask.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you really shouldn't be showing up the Torah because of the reward, then why did Hashem present it that way? If you do the Torah, you'll get all those nice things, and if you don't, you don't.
Wow. I think that's a very good question. I guess what I meant was, let me say what I meant. I should use the expression that you shouldn't do it for ulterior motives, so to speak. Your motive should be to serve God, right? That's the ideal motive for keeping the Torah. I want to do the will of God. I want to serve God. It is interesting. First of all, this is a big topic in and of itself. May I actually give another shiur on reward and punishment. But I'll just say briefly, first of all, I emphasize that the reward and punishment that are mentioned in the Torah are really for the Jewish people as a whole, right? I'm not talking about individual reward and punishment. When I was talking before about someone who's a bit gayer or like rude or something, more on an individual level. And while we believe the Torah also promises eternal reward, you know, olam haba and so forth, for the individual, it's not given a lot of emphasis if you think about it. It's nowhere mentioned in the Torah, right? Any in Tanakh and in the Torah itself, whenever reward and punishment are mentioned, it's mentioned for the community as a whole. No individual has any guarantee, okay? Where it does come up in Chazal, you know, the idea, olam haba for that matter is not spelled out in the Torah, right? It does come up as Chazal. It's definitely a belief, you know, of the Jewish people and olam haba and so forth. But it's not stressed. I think one of the reasons it's not stressed is for that reason, that we as individuals shouldn't be serving God for our ulterior motives because we're going to get olam haba, or because, you know, we're going to get wealthy or do well in the test or, you know, whatever it is, you know what I'm saying? Right, on the tzibur level, so that has to be explained, right? But it's also on the tzibur level, then, you know, no individual has a guarantee that he's going to make it to the end, you know, when you get the reward and punishment. You know, you follow what I'm saying? So it's a great question. It's worthy of a better answer than I'm giving you right now. It's definitely true. All right. Any other questions or anything?
And then where does Kibbutz Morim fit into
your intention?
Because that's
in other words, you're right, that the Torah for certain mitzvot does spell out, like it spells out a long life for Kibbutz Avim or for Shiluach HaKan. You know, although there too, you know, there's a famous story in the Gemara about the father tells his child to go get some eggs from a nest. And so he climbs the ladder and he shoos away the mother bird like he's required to do, and then, you know, falls to his death. So here the Torah promises a long life for Kibbutz Avim. He's doing what his father asked him to do. He's also to fulfill the mitzvah Shiluach HaKohen, which again the Torah promises a long life for. So how do you explain it, you know? They used to have a when you could advertise tobacco when I was a kid, they used to have a commercial for Winston cigarettes. So, and they at that time they were advertising a long cigarette, right? So they said, you know, and there were a lot of companies that were doing it. Winston's model was, it's not how long you make it, it's how you make it long. You know, that we make a finer cigarette or whatever kind of thing. So I guess life's like that also, right? It's not how long you make it, it's how you make it long. You know, in other words, we don't know what the quote final outcome was for this young man who, you know, fulfilled the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avim and then did the Shiluach HaKohen and so forth. I guess your question goes that the Torah does occasionally mention individual reward and punishment, and then there are punishments that Beit Din gives, right? They give the death penalty or they give Malkot and so forth. It's not without totally devoid of reward and punishment for individuals. But that's not the thrust of it. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say that's the thrust of it. And usually, with regard to what Bateman gives reward and punishment for, it's specific acts, right? It's not judging a person as a whole or anything like that. You know, if a person, you know, was a chal shabbat, or if a person committed a murder, or a person, you know, wore shatnez or did some other sort of error for which he receives a certain punishment. So he gets it for the specific error. It's not judging the person as a whole in the sense of we're talking about here judging the Jewish people as a whole, or someone getting all of above for his whole life, so to speak, right? And then they say, you know, with regard to Shiloh HaKen, for example, they say, if for such a, quote, little mitzvah, the reward is so great, think what it is for other mitzvah, you know, which seem more chashuv, yeah.
Not only that, but it speaks partially.
Yeah.
The brachot and the klalot are a klalila.
Right.
Because there were people who kept Torah and people who did it.
Right.
If the majority weren't, then the righteous got swept
right.
out of the law.
Right.
So it's not a, if you keep Torah, you're going to be rewarded by another.
Right. That's how I was stressing before. It's more the tzibur, it's more the community.
That
not the people as a whole, not by the individual. What?
Is that the deciding factor, the majority?
I don't know. He said that. What's your name?
Yaakov.
Yaakov said that.
Maybe it's qualitative. Quantitative.
Right. It's, only God can judge these things, right? You know, it's like Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur also. They say if each person should view himself as if he does one more mitzvah, he can tip the scales. If he does one more avera, he can tip the scales, Rahman Litzlan, the other way, right? So part, but we don't know, as you just said, what's the importance of any one mitzvah or one avera. You know, we have to try to do our best to help ourselves and the Jewish people for that matter. Yeah.
Rabbi Victor Miller, who commented on this,
right.
was that when the majority is on the wrong side, then the righteous gets swept out. He's referring in particular to the Shoah.
Right. It could be, what's your name?
Shlomo,
it could be what Shlomo said, you know, that in other words, how, even if it's true, it's rove, it's majority. But who, how, no one can possibly know what the rove is except God, right? That's how I emphasize also that the difference between a human court and the divine court is that the human court can only judge the person on the score of a single act, right? The Rambam emphasizes it. Did the person wear shanas or didn't wear shanas? Were there witnesses or there weren't witnesses, you know, so forth. All the technicalities and so forth. Only God can look at an individual or at the community for that matter and weigh everything they've done from the time that they were born until the time that they died. You know, everything they said, every experience they had, everything that, every choice they made, every conversation. I mean, who? I don't think most people, we're not even capable of judging ourselves on that basis, much less someone else. You know.
Can also get punished, maybe,
yeah.
for sins of your fathers. That's not necessarily from when you're born to either.
All right, that's a topic in and of itself also. We also do tshuva. We say, I'm a single chatanu, so to speak. But usually when we talk about, quote, the fifth, it's when the children do the same, they make the same mistakes, the same errors, the same averot that the fathers made. Yeah. All right. Any other questions or anything? Okay.
Thank
all right, nice meeting with all of you.